All right, welcome. I am Kevin Griffin. I don't know why I laugh at that, but just pretty funny. And we're going to meditate, and then we're going to talk. And I don't have a lot prepared. It's been a really interesting week. A lot of sort of Dharma teachings, opportunities, and reflections. I mentioned before we started recording that I was on a podcast yesterday. I think it's called In Search of Wisdom, now that I think of it. And it's always interesting to get interviewed, because I don't get to sort of choose the questions, and they're different from the types of questions I get from people who are just coming to a class. It's more like sort of journalistic, I suppose. So it was interesting. He was asking me some questions kind of coming out of my book of daily reflections, and talking about suffering and the cause of suffering. Oh, one of all my favorite topics. I think we can just meditate. I'll figure out what to do after that. Count on the Dharma to inspire. I guess I don't have to do anything. I'm like moving my cursor around, realizing, oh no, I'm not doing anything now. So as usual, settling into a comfortable and supportive meditation posture, which might be sitting up, might be upright, but it could also be reclining if you need to be in that posture. But mostly I recommend that if you really have a physical limitation. It's easier to, generally easier, I would say, to sort of balance relaxation and concentration, or relaxation and alertness. Easier to balance those things when you're upright. It's easy to get drowsy when you're lying down. In any case, however you are sitting, you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Again, just what works for you in your practice. It's important for us to really take ownership of our own meditation practice, not try to follow just what someone else's idea of how we should practice. And so turning inward, the kind of most natural thing that happens when we close our eyes, when we feel the body more, feel the sensations of the other senses become more attuned. So we might notice sounds as well, sensations, thoughts passing through the mind. It can be helpful to do some intentional relaxation, relaxing the jaw, releasing the shoulders, softening the belly, or just a sense of releasing the be a feeling of kind of being drawn to the earth. And also kind of releasing the resistance to feeling the whole of your body, the whole of your physical experience. Letting yourself tune in and become absorbed in awareness of the body. You might start to perceive the body, this more energetic level, a sense of a field of energy. But it's not so much these component parts. It's just this overall felt experience. As you feel the body breathing. The breath is a natural thing to notice when you tune into the body. It's something that's always moving. The in-breath and the out-breath each have their own special quality. Distinct. When the Buddha teaches mindfulness of breath, he starts with just awareness of the length of the breath. And then he suggests feeling the breath as we feel the whole body. In this way, it's a kind of open awareness, not trying to focus on a minute sensation, but rather a more general open awareness of breathing happening, the overall feeling of that, but in the context of the whole body. We can think of awareness and the way we apply awareness in meditation as having potentially different sizes or spatial dimensions, where you might focus on a very particular area. Sometimes people do, just feeling the breath at the nostrils, trying to keep the attention very narrow. But this other way I'm suggesting is more open than that. We talk about it as space, mental space, or space of awareness, a space that contains those sensations of breath, but also contains the sensations of the whole body as well. And part of the idea of this approach is that it's less effortful. It's not a striving to sort of block anything out or make the attention very precise. It's more of just a kind of watching the clouds kind of attitude. In this case, the clouds are the body and the breath. And even as we practice in this way, the mind will get captured by thoughts, projections, plans. So when you notice that, just acknowledging where the mind is, and gently come back. Come back to the breath and the space. Body. And notice if there's any tendency to judge the wandering mind or some frustration with thoughts happening or the interruption. Your awareness with thoughts. This is just another thought. And we can fall into this kind of feedback loop. Oh, I'm thinking, I shouldn't be thinking. Oh, wait, I'm thinking about thinking. Why am I doing that? What's wrong with me? This whole unhelpful story can start up. So, whenever you notice whatever level of that or behavior of the mind, just see if you can hold it with kindness, with acceptance. It's just the mind doing what it does. Not really something you have control over. You have influence, but not control. Okay. Yeah, I don't have really even a starting point tonight. I tend to get very distracted before I travel, and even lightheaded. I think noticing that today, fear of travel, loss of control. But where I've arrived Burning Desire, which is one place of reference right now, teaching is the section on concentration. So I think it's a good topic. And just to mention that this chapter is called The Higher Power of the Eightfold Path. And the whole book is about higher power and Dharma, Dharma as a higher power. But in this chapter, I only cover seven elements of the Eightfold Path because I have an entire chapter on mindfulness earlier in the book. So I jump from right effort to right concentration from the sixth element of the path to the eighth. Let's see if I could find this reference as well. No, not handy. It's very interesting to to parse out the difference between concentration and mindfulness. And I think I don't think we can really 100% draw a clean line between the two. So maybe I should talk a little bit about why I think that. When we talk about mindfulness, start with just the way mindfulness meditation is taught. So people say, typically a meditation teacher will say, bring your attention to the breath, start to feel your breath, right? And then they'll say, and if your mind wanders, then come back to your breath. Okay, and there could be lots of different variations on that. But that's the sort of basic idea. Just keep coming back to your breath. And strictly speaking, that's actually a concentration practice more than a mindfulness practice. Because concentration is, as it's structured as a practice, is done by repeatedly coming back to a single object. Mindfulness has another real way of functioning altogether. Mindfulness is much more about the attention itself. Now, mindfulness, the Buddha describes these different realms of mindfulness, different things to pay attention to. So it's about directing the attention and being fully with an experience. And that's different from just coming back to a particular object. Joseph Goldstein says, a moment of mindfulness is a moment of concentration, which points to the way that they are bound up together. They're not really separate. But the importance of concentration in a mindfulness practice is that concentration is what sustains the attention in a particular place. Mindfulness is the application of the attention to a particular experience so that you are fully feeling or experiencing or knowing some experience. And it is accompanied with a lack of resistance, a lack of clinging. Mindfulness implies a kind of acceptance. There isn't aversion or grasping. There isn't reactivity. But the thing that keeps the mindfulness there beyond just one breath is the concentration. So it's, although I accept what Joseph says, I think it has a way of kind of, it can be confusing in a way, because it doesn't point to the importance of sustaining mindfulness. What happens as we sustain mindfulness on a particular experience is that our experience of that thing deepens. And then a lot of things unfold from that on just a kind of felt level. There's this increasing sense of serenity, increasing sense of embodiment, even a sense of pleasure, comfort, ease, all these positive qualities that we associate with meditation. So on the felt level, there's this, we call that, as the meditation deepens, that is, as the mindfulness is sustained over time, there's this deepening calm, deepening state of peace. And then on the perceptual level, there is an increased awareness and sensitivity to the details of experience. So we start to perceive more subtle elements of the experience. And this then opens the door into then the critical piece, the insight. Because as we start to see and perceive differently, certain things can start to stand out, and certain aspects of experiences can start to stand out, which is what the Buddha is pointing to. It's pointing to notice as your perception becomes more subtle. Notice the impermanent nature of things. Notice, and you'll recognize these things. Notice the unsatisfactory nature of things. Notice the not self nature of things. So this is the three characteristics: dukkha, anicca, anatta, suffering, impermanence, not self. Now, these don't necessarily present themselves as kind of billboards in our mind. It takes both the guidance of the Buddha, his teachings, the Dharma, and it can help to have a teacher, and also a certain understanding from ourselves, sort of to look for those things. So in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, after establishing concentration in body and mind, the Buddha says to bring attention to impermanence. So it's not just that you're sitting there and like, okay, I'm just hanging out. Oh, look, everything's impermanent. No, it's okay. I can feel that my mind is really steadied. I'm very settled. I'm going to intentionally now try to observe very closely the impermanent nature of my experience. So there's a participation in seeing this, these insights. But going back to this point about concentration, without the sustained mindfulness, impermanence is only experienced on a gross level, you know, in the ordinary way that we do, which to understand impermanence and to reflect on impermanence is valuable on just that level. It's not to dismiss that. But the suggestion from the Buddha and from the masters who have followed the Buddha is that through a combination of profound concentration, sustained mindfulness, and then intentional reflection or contemplation, observance of this quality of impermanence, that there can come a kind of break, or called a breakthrough, in which our ordinary way of perceiving reality changes. We could also say that it's not that there's another level of letting go that happens. So what that letting go is about is our deeply conditioned perception of reality as being made up of solid elements, of solid things, right? And just, you know, I use that word perception very intentionally because I said before that one of the results, what happens as we sustain mindfulness with concentration over time, is that our perception changes. So this is how it happens, right? So that perception, we all live in this perception, right? This is our ordinary perception that our bodies are solid. Yeah, they're not, you know, they might be mushy around the edges. And yeah, I noticed that, you know, gradually it changes, but it's basically my body. And this computer, this thing I'm looking at, this table, and the guitar across the room, you know, that these are all just objects. And on a functional level, they are just objects. And they that's how we operate in the world, as though our body is an object and things around us are objects. And that's fine, but their reality is that they aren't objects in the sense of being solid, immutable, permanent things. Everything is in flux. And so why is it useful to have this shift in perspective? And what is the problem with having the perspective that things are solid? Even if we can say, oh yeah, it's on an atomic level, everything's changing, but that doesn't really matter to me because, you know, I still can't walk through walls, you know. So it comes back to the basic problem that the Buddha talks about in the Four Noble Truths, which is that our clinging is the source of our problems, right? That our clinging to thoughts, to feelings, to perceptions, to objects, to people, places, and things is the source of our suffering. And that if we can let go of that clinging, that we can be free from suffering. So this breakthrough can happen because when we see the profound impermanent nature of all things, it becomes apparent that they are ungraspable, that we cannot cling to things that are not solid, that are not that don't actually last. And so that clinging, we realize that that strategy is a failed strategy. And this realization, again, is not just this isn't talking about an intellectual understanding, because that doesn't really solve it for us, right? Because it's so deeply ingrained, so deeply conditioned. The underlying conditioning, underlying tendencies, the Buddha talks about. So this has to be uprooted. You know? And the way the Buddha says that this can be uprooted is by sustaining your concentration on your mindfulness and concentration long enough and deeply enough that your perception changes. And at a certain point, there's a shift. You know, and people describe it in different ways, you know, talking about like when you have one of those drawings that's two things, it's a swan or it's a woman's head, you know, and you're looking at it and all you can see is a swan. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, wait, now all I can see is a woman's head. For an addict, it's not unlike the breakthrough into recovery, in which our perception of reality changes radically. And our perception of ourselves, our perception of who we are, our perception of what we need, what we want, all of that can happen very suddenly. This is called a moment of clarity in the 12-step literature. So it's not to think of this as something sort of mystical or beyond us, but rather to see it as, oh yeah, that's something that is doable, because it is. Buddha says, I wouldn't teach this if it weren't possible for you to do this. So coming back to this point of concentration, which is my theme here, and many of you, if not all of you, have heard me talk about this idea that what's really necessary for concentration is the thing that's probably most precious in life, and that is time. You know, what defines the limits of our life is the amount of time we're alive. What we do with that time, you know, that's our life. And so it's not just an easy thing to say, spend more time meditating, because there's other things you want to do with your time. And we're all drawn to other activities and we have other needs. But one of the main points of a meditation retreat is to take that time where you can practice mindfulness in a sustained way over a period of days or weeks or months or even years. Because it can look to someone sort of someone doesn't know about the Buddhist practice of meditation retreat can look really odd to someone when someone says, well, I'm going to go on a retreat for 3 months. Wow, what are you going to do? I'm going to meditate. Well, why are you going to meditate for that long? You know, and I don't want to, make this the idea of a retreat simplistic and say it's just about concentrating, developing concentration. However, concentration is one of the main reasons why we go on retreat and why we particularly go on longer retreats. Very difficult to get to this state of breakthrough in a short period of time. You know, I would never say never, because many people have enlightenment experiences out of the blue that don't even involve meditating. But the, you know, there's a great expression about meditation that about enlightenment. Enlightenment is an accident, and meditation makes you accident prone. And I think that's a good way to think of it. So the more the sustaining your meditation makes you more accident prone. If you keep walking on that tightrope, the chances get more and more that you're going to fall off. It's sort of an opposite image, but yeah. In this case, falling off the tightrope is the thing you want to do. But anyway, I guess that kind of blows that. So I guess one of the reasons, you know, it seemed like a topic for me to be talking about is that I'm going to be teaching a retreat next week. And one of the joys of teaching a retreat is that you get to meditate a lot while you're doing it. So maybe I'll have my own breakthrough next week. Concentration, nonetheless, I'll say a little bit more and then open it up. There's so many different sort of approaches to it that I think it's wise to listen to everybody, try multiple approaches until you find something that seems to work for you. And then stick with that, you know, sustain your relationship to that for a while, and see what happens. You know, and this is, you know, basically we're talking about techniques of meditation, because you know, kind of the techniques of meditation are about the three aspects of the Eightfold Path that are focused on meditation. They're about mindfulness, effort, and concentration. And so how we use those elements and what we sort of, how we make up those elements sort of defines the form of meditation we're doing, you know, whether you're doing a mantra or a loving kindness or counting your breaths or just feeling the space of mind. There are many different approaches. There's something I also often say, which is that teachers tend to teach the things that worked for them as well they might. But I think it's wise for students to keep that in mind, so that if you find yourself kind of banging your head against the wall with the practice that somebody's been teaching, then maybe try something else. You know, maybe you need to bang your head against the wall. That's not always a bad thing. I mean, yeah, best if you don't injure yourself. But, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing to be challenged and struggle. It's not to ever suggest that meditation is going to always be easy, and if it's difficult, it's not the right meditation. That's not true at all. But I think it's good to experiment, and over time, I've certainly gone through you know, different styles of practice and different approaches to practice. And you know, I've been practicing for over 40 years, and I would say there's probably been sort of four or five different phases of my practice in those years. You know, when I could point to, oh yeah, for that 5 years I was doing a lot of this, or you know, this was my main practice for this 10 years, and so I'm not talking about, oh, let's try every practice in the book, but to really be open and to experiment I thought I would read just a little piece from Ajahn Suchito, who has a new book that's called, it's about breath. It's about, it's called Breathing Like a Buddha. Yeah, I thought that life. Breathing Like a Buddha. And he says, I was introduced to meditation in 1975 through a systematic approach of maintaining moment by moment mindfulness of the sensations associated with breathing. I found that approach to be useful for discipline, but quite intense and demanding, and not conducive to joy and ease. Moreover, when I looked into the original texts, I found that they didn't mention awareness of physical sensations, nor of mindfulness as a practice of tracking sensations a moment at a time. Though these references are plausible interpretations of, quote, mindfully one knows one is breathing in, breathing out, unquote. But as an exploration, I went back to the basics of noticing how I was aware of breathing, which is just an interesting phrase, and picked up on the fluid rhythm of the life force that the physical act of breathing moves and moderates. So just, and I read that not so much, oh, you should do what he's saying, but to point to how this very experienced monk has gone through his own process of like finding what works for him. And, you know, that he did one practice for some years, struggled with it. It was useful, but, you know, and so, yeah, meditation should be a creative, explorative practice. And that doesn't mean you should, you know, be trying to, you know, whatever, do something. What am I going to say? Not mystical, but, you know, magical. Like if I say these words or I do this mantra, then, you know, or if I stand on my head, what'll happen? You know, the Buddha tried all the crazy possibilities, you know, like I'll stop breathing or I'll stop eating. And, you know, none of that stuff worked. So that's not the point. But still, to kind of keep the mind open, is this working? What's happening? And, you know, and keep reading, keep listening to different teachers. So I will open it up. There's a long direct message to me in the chat, which I just cannot, I'm sorry, I can't read it and respond to it and still be present for the group. So I apologize for that. So I will open it up to if there are any questions or comments tonight. Well.
I'll share something.
Oh, goody. Thank you, Deb. Good to hear from you.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you. I don't know what I want to share about, you know, an experience from my retreat or something, an experience I had at a retreat like a week and a half before that. Both very, very different focuses of concentration. Several weeks ago, I was at a day-long, and we had a Tibetan nun who was there offering some practices as well. And I chose, you know, with the option to focus, to meditate with my eyes open and focusing on the rose that was in the middle of the room, the rose that was in the middle of the circle. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when I'm meditating with my eyes open, I have a soft gaze, no focus of anything in particular, just being present. So it opens up to that kind of spacious awareness and noticing the comings and goings of things. That practice of focusing on that rose was very different. I haven't done that in years, I have to say. And it was just a totally different experience. and really staying with that focus of the rose and just starting to see the energy shifts and changes. And, you know, of course, we meditate and practice and we experience everything through the body and the aggregates, you know, of form and perception and feeling tones and all of that. And all of that kind of arose and was very present in just in this rose. And I can't tell you how many shapes and forms and dissolvings and then concentrating as this rose expressed. So it was a really interesting experience and something that opened another awareness for me. So I'm just sharing that because I, you know, in congruence with what you're offering, try something, see what works, what doesn't. And sometimes a certain type of meditation is really what's being called for in your life in a moment of time, and to be open to the variety of options that we have.
Yeah, and you're also talking about how perception is impermanent, right? Because that's what's, you know, when the, you know, you think, well, that's just a rose. It is what it is. But because you're not actually seeing the rose, you're seeing your mental experience of this visual object, and your mind is constantly changing. And so, you know, your eyesight is constantly changing. So the thing, as your mind changes, the thing appears to change in front of you, even though presumably it hasn't actually changed. I mean, it's going through its own change, but you can't probably really see that.
Yes, yes. And so there's that recognition of arising, presence, and cessation. This is the ultimate truth, right?
Yeah.
To see that and to be aware of that. So, yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, when I try to focus particularly on arising and cessation, when I was talking about this yesterday on this podcast, it becomes apparent that there isn't any arising or cessation. That is to say, there is no beginning and end to things. That's a creation of mind. There is just being, you know, it's just thusness, as I say. And so I actually have a difficulty with this idea of notice things arise, because all that I notice arise is my own perception. That's what I'm noticing arising, is my perception of something arising. Oh, now I'm aware of this. Oh, now I'm not aware of it anymore. So what arose and ceased was only the perception, not the object itself. I don't know if that's
right. No, I'm with you on that too, because doing an awareness practice on retreat of just noticing, you know, what was coming to the foreground and the background, I recognized that my mind was starting to chase the pain in the body, the suffering in the body. It was going from one to the next to the next. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, why? I'm caught in this physical samsara right now, you know? But my body has more than that. At any one time, there's neutral, there's pleasant, there's unpleasant. So I was able to expand my awareness and start to become aware and perceive, as you're saying, there was more than what my mind wanted to gravitate to.
Yeah.
That was quite spacious. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, working with pain, I think, is one of the most interesting things. And, you know, for me, that's been one of the most productive areas of practice, mainly around, similarly to what you're saying, it's not so much that I change what I'm focusing on as I change how I'm focusing on it. That when I don't like it, or I don't want the pain, then I'm in this, it usually triggers restlessness, that I'm like, let me get a little bit, when is the bell going to ring, you know? And then when I surrender to it and just breathe, and there is an expansiveness around that, in the sense of, I don't know, holding the breath and holding the experience. It's not that I'm taking my mind away from the pain, but maybe you're saying the same thing, that I'm expanding to experience, oh, the whole of the body. And then there's this sensation in it, but I'm not, but again, for me, the thing that is the key is that I'm not resisting the sensation. And actually I try to get absorbed into it, because absorption, meditative absorption is what is one of the ways you transform the perception of something. It is essentially the way you transform the perception of something. So if you can get absorbed in any object, it becomes pleasant. That's why, because absorption is inherently pleasant, which is, the Buddha said this when he was dying, that the only time that he wasn't in back pain, didn't have back pain, was when he was in absorption. Maybe a different, experience from what you're describing.
Yeah. No, there were, I experienced some of that type of presence as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I think probably the more useful point for everybody is that when you're struggling, especially with physical pain, and because this happens on retreats a lot, because you're sitting still and the body doesn't like that, mm-hmm. that it's really good to experiment with ways of working with it, and working with your mindfulness, working with your concentration, working with your perception, your attitude toward it, and see if you can find some way of, whether it's taking the attention somewhere else, absorbing into it, saying words of loving kindness to it, whatever. Play with it and experiment and see if there's a way of being with the experience that's manageable, that's not a struggle. Because that is definitely one of the potentials, and one of the really rich and valuable potentials of cultivating concentration. Mm-hmm. So I think we've passed our 8 o'clock time here on the west coast of the North America, past the hour. And I appreciate people coming tonight. As I say, I will be here on next Tuesday. And did I say you were going to be there doing it next Friday, Deb?
The 6th, yeah.
Okay, so that's not next Friday. Next Friday must be, Anne and Walt are going to be covering some of the other times. And And I'm going to do the Spirit Rock class, which will be on the 9th of September. And that will be, I'll be in New York, assuming, everything that is planned plays out in the way it's meant to, but it'll be 10 o'clock at night for me in New York, so hopefully that works. Anyway, I hope everybody stays well.